session number 10165, reel number 38.
Martin McLean, reel 38. Now, you were about to set off to go to war with the Japanese. What was the reputation of the Japanese amongst the troops? They'd been very successful in the war so far. Were the troops nervous of them at all, or thought they had unfair advantage in jungle warfare?
Our opinions, we hadn't been involved with action at this date with the Japanese, were that you had to treat the Japs with great caution. They had been well trained in jungle warfare, whereas we hadn't. In truth, the troops were a bit frightened of the jungle, especially where the Japs were, because they were so good at ambush schemes where they'd put pits in the ground with sharpened bamboo and you fall in them and pin yourself on these slivers of bamboo and things that came down from the tree, as you've seen, no doubt, in the Vietnam stories and wars.
And you'd heard about that sort of thing?
We heard about it, yes. And they were very good at ambush, which was their outstanding feature. Ambush and camouflage. That was the only thing we were frightened of. Man to man, we weren't frightened of them. We were ready to fight them. This long march had to start. Now, it was a three-day march, in night time. I don't know exactly when it was, but I don't know how long the march was, but it had to be done of a night time. We set off on this march. Now,
do you know what date it was, roughly?
Well, it was getting on to March, 1943. Because the incidents I'm going to talk about were in March. We were down there a very short way before we were involved. March 43. I was drunk. And I was disgusted with myself because of being a man, I'd rollicked him for it. But I conducted myself pretty well. I carried my kit and my water bottle. And, you know, the spirit was making me parch for the want of a drink of water. And I wouldn't touch my water bottle, no way, because I wouldn't allow the men to touch them. And that was our drill discipline. I was clamming, I'd have given anything for a drink of water or something to slake me thirst during this night march. Now, a night march, you've got to look at it this way. You're laden up with about 70-odd pound of kit. The weight of kit that I carried, I had weighed on scales, this as well carrying myself, was 79 pound. That's with grenades, Thompson submachine gun, and all the sort of rubbish that we had to carry. It was rubbish. Physically and truthfully and machine-wise, they were rubbish. We carried these down, and as you walk along a ground that's been bulldozed or even tread by mules and things of that nature, the ground is not level, whereas you're used with walking and seeing where you're walking. We had done night marches, but we didn't have to march on a night march over rough ground. We were invariably on tracks and roads, well-worn tracks. You'd walking along and the ground wasn't level, and you'd drop down maybe 6 inches or maybe 3 inches, and with this weight of the kit, and you're just not, your foot not hitting the bottom, you've got a sudden jolt. And it made it a very hard march in that. Apart from me suffering so much. And we marched all night. And we at daylight, were in a jungle. Actually, were in an area. There was great big huge trees. I don't know what they were. But somebody said they were hardwood trees. And they had huge veins. They're great tall trees. And they seemed to have a great vein coming away from them. A ridge of wood. Three or four of them. Mainly three, and they were planted in the ground a long way off the base of the tree, and they were anchored in. You see them in these jungle pictures, you see. Huge trees with great long, massive things starting from about 10 foot or more, trailing down the ground. Just like the rudder of a ship, I'd say, coming down anchoring the ground. They were made, in fact, for rainforests and of that nature. Now, this area we're in was a rainforest because it was a well-known place for malaria. It was a red belt. Now, if you're conversing with them sort of things, the health people had marked off areas on their geological maps, areas in red, which is badly infested malarial areas. Well, it was both a low seawater area and also a land that held a lot of water. We halted and looked at these trees and we found they were teak trees. I believe somebody said they were teak. Hundreds of them, and would harbour there for the night. They would have food of some description. I didn't remember much about food, but it would be a haversack ration. I don't suppose the cooks were keeping up with us or anyone of that nature. The mules were there. Whether the corporal cook would be there. He'd provide something, cup of tea, some corned beef stew or corned beef and biscuits. But we'd have something. But the CQMS wouldn't be there. We'd feed, and then next night we're off again. I was feeling a bit better this night. But that first night, I'll never forget it, and I'll never forget them officers for it. I say that jokingly, but they did nearly kill me. I was really damnant about it. I thought they'd done us a bad turn. CQMS was all right. He was back. It was me that was marching. And every time they saw me, they were sniggering because they knew I was drunk. They were having a great bit of fun. We marched for 3 or 4 nights, and on one of our marches, it was becoming daylight, and we marched through a concentration of troops, and it was a place called Indin. And it was the first time we'd seen really infantry Indian men, Indian soldiers, in bulk. We'd seen them, you know, wandering around the streets, but here they were all in fighting order. Some of them wore their cap comforter. Cap comforter is a woolen thing which we use for scarves. You see, the commanders used to wear them, pull them over the head. They were wearing them, and they also had hats like that. And they turned out to be Rajputs, machine gunners, or the Jats machine gunners, I don't know which. There's a lot of big concentration of troops in that area that had huts and bashes, I should say, not huts, bashes, buildings made of bamboo. And there was a concentration of artillery there. We passed through them looking around, curious what's happening, you know. On we went, and we came to a place further on where we spread out into company positions, company lagers, all round defence, and took a position. We then, not very far from the positions we had took over from the Indians, all kitted out, we checked our weapons, checked our ammunition. We had this ammunition that we'd had in England, and I stood by this stuff. I thought it was great stuff. We'd been through waterproofing. It stood all the tests of waterproofing and everything. It could still fire with accuracy. Our grenades, I doubt about them because water could get on the top of them once you'd put the primer in the bottom. There's like a hole in that could get in there. And the same with the 68 grenade which we had, which was a plastic thrown grenade. Not of such a serious nature as a Mills' grenade. Cause a bang, and plastic would splinter up instead of the steel from a 36 grenade.
Was that to get the greater range, or was it for
a better thrown? I think further thrown. And as you flung it, a weight inside of it, and on the end of a tape, the tape unwounded, and it pulled a little pin out, which set the fuse off and landed and exploded. But the Mills' grenade was you put the igniter set in the bottom. A lot of people wouldn't hear to charge them because the igniter set was fulminate of mercury and a bit of quick friction could blow it up and set it off. But again, being an experienced soldier, I wasn't worried of them. We had them all charge all with grenades and everything ready for going up the front. My company got the reserve job. The other companies led off before us, and the order was don't fire, no shooting. It doesn't matter what you see or think you see in front of you. You must see the whites of the eye of a Japanese before you fire. Well, my company was in a reserve position. And in this reserve position, it was about 200 yards behind the remainder. In other words, the reserve position is a company that's as ready and able and to be called on short notice to go in to break to do a counter-attack against an attack or to take over a breach in the line where the Japs or the enemy have broke through. We were in this reserve position, but we were in contact with you could say the front. There was a bit of a Chung running in front of us. Chung is a small river. It flowed in front of us, but we could see the front and what was happening. We could nearly see down to Fowl Point. It wasn't much of a jungle where we were. It was more or less a seafront with a huge scattering of trees. As we come further inland from the sea, you got jungle. And there was huge high hills on the left of us. It was a mountain ridge. I forget the name of the mountain ridge, but it was a mountain ridge. We'd march along at the bottom of it all the way along. Mayhew Peninsula, I think it was. Mayhew Peninsula. We took up this defence position, and our first night in position, not a shot was fired. And the Japs couldn't understand what had happened, because all night long, the Indians had been firing thousands of rounds of ammunition. It may be the least little movement, an animal, but it set the whole front off, while we were ordered not to fire, which was a bad thing, really, in the long run, leading up the story I tell. In short, we didn't have a chance to test our weapons. Thompson submachine gun again. Under this, we were in this reserve position, and then we got orders that we were going to attack the Sugar 5 and Sugar 4 positions. Now, Sugar 4, Sugar 5, and there's two other positions which I can't exactly remember. I have them written down somewhere, but I haven't got them at hand. I think they come in L3 and L2 or something. Anyway, somebody had given them these Japanese bunkers, this kitab, this name. And that's what they were on all reference maps and all books. And we were to attack Sugar 4 and Sugar 5. Prior to this, the company we had relieved in this reserve position was the Royal Welsh Fusiliers. They had got up there before us, and they had done an attack on these Sugar 4 and 5 and suffered severe casualties.
These blocks were... What sort of defensive positions were these Sugar 4
and 5? All the while, were a mound in the ground with, like, a huge bunker with little holes in where they could shoot out of. Just a mound of earth with no supporting troops around. Maybe a trench leading from them, but no supporting troops around them. The Japs were great at defence. I'll stop here to explain a bit. The Japanese were great at defence of this nature. I told you, Sugar 4, Sugar 5. They'd be in there. There'd be nobody above ground. Maybe two or three for throwing grenades or scatter around to give information of approaching troops. There was definitely people in little holes for to throw grenades in their camouflage positions, because they caught one of my platoons and really knocked them up, which I'll lead on to later. They'd have these positions so sighted they could cover one another by fire. And the same with the other two positions, they'd cover them. They'd cover each other by fire. And up on the hills, they had a lot of positions which the British and Indian troops tried to get rid of in many different ways, which we'll come to. And they used to fire down onto them positions as well, just giving them complete coverage and all sorts of fire against attack. In other words, when you attack them, you're going to a hail of shots.
Did they have, at small arms, did they have any, and machine guns, I presume, did they have any artillery in support, the Japanese?
No. Oh, they had in the distance, but very little.
What about
the
British?
It was mountain batteries. The British had, we had with us the 99th Field Artillery, which was the Buckinghamshire and an Oxenbucks Yeomanry. So I met one the other day at this funeral I told you about, the lad, and he was delighted to meet somebody being up the front with him. They had this, the 25-pounders supporting us. Now, whatever else was there, I don't know, but I think it was just 25-pounders, because it was a difficult job getting them up, you know. It was jungle and rough tracks and whatever. I think that was all that was up there.
And what preparations and plans did you have for this attack?
No. I'll tell you about the Royal Welsh Fusiliers attack first. Artillery barrage went over, tremendous artillery barrage. And the sergeant major that I took over from, I took over the reserve ammunition that he had in the hole. I've told you about that when I was talking about Rillington. You take over a reserve supply of ammunition. In case you're involved with a sustained battle, you've got to have ammunition to give the lads more stuff for their guns and rifles and grenades and things. And I took over from this little sergeant major, and him and I had a chat. And he went away. Well, just prior to this attack, we were in a dried nullah bed, a dried up river bed. Imagine the water rushing down from the mountains of Mayhew Peninsula. It used to gouge the earth out the ground and sweep away in different areas and just sweep away and make either a permanent home for itself or just a branch line. But you could always find in this area, a very, very rough area, a nulla, which is a dried river bed. We were in there, and this unit we're in had taken over from an Indian unit. And the Indian unit had dug themselves in, into the sides of the hills. There's one particular one they gave me, it was under the roots of a tree, a huge, deep one. And I used to be in there on my own. I sat down, Tyneside. And I was up, just wandering around the nulla one day, and I heard a voice, "Samager, do you think you could rustle up some tea?" Well, we had spirit stoves, and we had our chagos of water and containers of water up in the company position. And I said, "Yes, sir." Well, I devised an idea, which the company, all the companies start using eventually. On this primary stove, it was a spirit stove, a little tin that you carried, you lit it, and the methylated spirits would cook one Dixie, a mess tin of water. Well, I decided, being an ex-engineer, that aluminium is a good conductor. I'll put water in the first one, then I'll put the other one on top, which will heat up, so that you can make a strong cup of tea in the first one and have hot water to fill up the cups with the other. And that's what I've done. And it proved a charm, this. I was able to supply mugs of tea to the company commander, and we had a visitor there, and Roger Stock, who was the second in command, I had a one, of course, and the third cup of tea went to a stranger. And they called me into this hall, into the bunker, "Samager, come here. Do you know who this is?" I said, "I'm sorry, don't you know this famous actor?" And I said, "No, I don't, I'm sorry." I said, "I'm not in touch with actors that much." It was, stop it a minute. It was Jack Hawkins. So we had a bit of talk, and he was telling us about his men going on the attack. Now, he was second in command, infantry second in command. Now, we talk about actors and things, but Jack had a good grounding. He was an infantry officer. He was second in command of this company. Now, at this time...
The Royal Welsh Fusiliers.
Royal Welsh Fusiliers. Now, at this time, second-in-command stayed with the company. But somewhere or another, an order originated on that special day that second-in-commands would leave the companies and go back to B echelon, which was the nearest where the cooks and things were, so that if the company commander got knocked out, he was available to be take over. And this, by him being there to take over, two officers may have got killed in the same incident, so that reducing the risk of them both being killed. So I met this officer, and the Royal Welsh went into the attack with the artillery pounding away with their smoke bombs to reduce the Japanese seeing any movements up in the hills and all over the shop. HE mixed with it, and were pounding away, and then the Royal Welsh went in. And in no time, the fight was over. They lost. They got beat. The Samager that I'd been talking to had been killed on one of the sugar positions, trying to throw grenades into the slit trench, into their positions. The attack failed. Now, there's no court inquiry of the survivors of that. Tell us about the ground. Tell us of what you saw. Is there any advice you can give any future attacks? Now, prior to this, a number of Indian battalions had done the same attack and failed. They sent in some honey tanks, a squadron of honey tanks into them, and they got stuck in the dried up nullahs and couldn't get out. One of the Indians done a brave job, and he got the VC in that area for getting out and attaching tow ropes into the tanks that were stuck and helping to get them out, but one was permanently stuck, they couldn't shift it. Just show you how good the Japs were. They even took the gun out of that tank and the guns, the automatic weapons, and installed them in their own. They were so clever in these sort of scrounging and make do. The British troops would never have thought of it. Would have passed the tank and said, "Look at that. A good gun." They had took it out and used it against the troops. So it was decided that we would do an attack. And it was decided about the 16th of March that we'd do the attack. Prior to this, they'd noticed that these bunkers were being supplied by a carrying party of Japanese coming up from Fowl Point each night with ammunition and food, or it was for these troops. So they decided to send our guerrilla platoon down. The guerrilla platoon was what used to be the pioneer platoon. that picked selected men and made them into, like, battalion commandos. And it was their job to go down under Lieutenant Wilson to ambush these Japanese. So there'd be about 30 men in the platoon, and nearly all armed with Thompson submachine guns. And they crossed the Nulla head, the Nulla water, the riverbed in front of us. And they avoided the defensive positions of the Japanese in the early morning. And they skirted around down by the coast. And they got themselves right down to 4 points. Now, I read a book recently of an officer who'd done a lot of fighting there, who became a general in the Indian Army. He says, if these troops could have got around there, why hadn't they sent a battalion in? No, that was a good point. If we got in there, we could have cut off all their supplies and hit Fall Point, which wasn't defended, but we never followed up with that. Somewhere along the line, maybe they're short of troops, don't know what it was, but we had four battalions with us. They could have, in my opinion, sent two battalions. No, I can see that afterwards. Sent two battalions wrong, but didn't. So they sent this guerrilla platoon down, and in a company, I share the night with the company commander, on duty, off duty, on duty, off duty. Well, during the night, the hours of the attack, I was stood to and fully armed and equipped. The majority of the men sleeping with double sentries in each post. Double sentries a section post, two men of a section awake, the rest sleeping. If they can sleep, well, they did. They were always tired.
And on duty, what were you supposed to do?
Just in case there was any alert, anything happened, then you'd rouse the company and get things happening. They had to have somebody awake and alert so they could inform the company commander what was happening, exactly what was happening. I was listening for the sound of the ambush going on, and I said they'll give them a hammer and them Thompson submachine guns, and then I heard thumps, banging. No sound of any rifle shots of any description. And then in come we were forward platoon, forward company, and then in come the guerrilla platoon, cursing and blinding. Which is, the soldier can use language, but they'd been in a desperate situation and they had to get out of it because the Thompson submachine guns all blew up. I told you there should have been a court inquiry on that Thompson submachine gun. The whole lot of them blew up. So they had no firepower apart from the one or two rifles and the grenades. But they'd done some great work with these grenades they had. They ambushed the Japanese and sorted them up good and proper. But if they had met any opposition on the way back, they were gunners. Say they'd met a company of Japanese or a platoon of Japanese, they had used their grenades, they had nothing at all. Of course, they dumped their Thompson submachine guns, which were useless, because they were running out now. That was an attack like that. You do your attack and get out as quickly as possible, which we're taught in our amphibious training at Carabasco. So they came out cursing and blinding. Now, we were to do an attack the next day. Orders came, stand, wait. And then the company commander says, we're taking the whole company out back to B echelon, Sergeant Major, to change every bit of ammunition we've got. The idea is now that the ammunition is damp through all the amphibious training.
And that was what was doing in the Thompsons, they reckon?
It was only assumed. Now, the American ammunition was, it was like a heavy piece of lead, four or five bullet pushed out, and were very heavy. They weren't waterproof, that's what they said. That's all we got to know, they weren't waterproof. But the Thompson submachine guns, you can remember how much firepower we lost. Each section commander had a one. I had a one. All that firepower lost in a company, and we were going to the attack with them. They never took mine off us and give us any alternative weapon. They'd let me go in with a Tommy gun that they knew were useless. And I knew it was useless now. So we went back to B echelon, and as Sergeant Major, I drew the ammunition, the grenades, and all this sort of stuff. And I took all the grenades off the men and told them, ensure there's no primers in. Take your primers out. And we'll put them in. The boxes have been dumped or flung away. We'll put them in sandbags and give them left them know the quartermasters. Actually, the RSM is responsible for ammunition. And we, Sergeant Majors, are responsible for ammunition up the companies. So we'll give them these bags of grenades and things like that. I nearly got myself killed. I thought I was a lucky man with one of them later on, after all the fighting. We changed all our ammunition. Now, I said I was an ex-engineer. I knew brass. And we got some brand new boxes of ammunition from Kirky Arsenal, printed on the lid. I broke the seals and opened up. And I said, they're funny looking ammunition. They were like a yellow, like them candlesticks over there, like a pale yellow. Now, that to me is a manganese brass, which is a cheap inferior brass. They were provided by Curti Arsenal, so you've got to accept the fact that they are a good, solid round of ammunition. We recharged with all our ammunition, and we set off that same day back to our... we had a night in the Echelon Harbour. It was just as well we did, because we were in all-round defence positions. And as a proven Jap patrol came through, trying to find a way through behind the army, into these positions, and there was a battle fight with us. We never saw them. We know there's some hits, because they found the blood and everything later on. But they carried their wounded out, or maybe, or the dead. And we had there was a little fight with one of our platoons, with the Japs, machine gun, Bren guns going, what have you. But we hadn't changed our ammunition then, let's put it that way. We just arrived out in the early evening, we still had our old ammunition. Bren guns were firing great. Next day we changed our ammunition, loaded up, and we went back to our old position in reserve. Everyone was briefed what happened. 11 platoon on the left flank, 10 platoon on the right flank, 9 platoon was being detached to do a little job of their own, and company headquarters had to follow 10 and 11 platoon in. Now, we marched through the dry river bed to our forming up positions in the dark, formed up in this dry river bed, dried nuller bed. There was a series of them. It seemed to be every few yards was a dried river bed. Now, this place before us had supposed to be fully reconnoitred. Now, this is where, I mean, if somebody had questioned the people in the attack, what was it like in front? What was the ground like? What was the hindrances of troops and things like that? Don't forget, we were carrying, at the average, 76 pound of kits. The company lined up in this dry river bed for the assault. 10 platoon on the right, left 11 on the left, scattered out, and leaning against the bed, and the artillery barrages were going over. Everything was dust and muck in the early morning light. Company commander said, give the order, bayonets on. I passed it around, bayonets on. The company commander says, smoke if you want. And the men dragged out cigarettes, and they're hanging on to them for grim death, because let's not be heroic. A man is only going to do a job that he's ordered to do. If he was volunteering to do it, he wouldn't do it, because he's going in to do an attack, and the chance of him being killed are tremendous, which proved the case. It was a nasty attack that we done. The order came, right, get ready, over the top the two platoons went, and I led on with my platoon headquarters, and I've been told the company commander was leading us, and he disappeared. He says, next dry river bed, Sergeant, hold them there, wait. Now, I had the signalers with me and the runners. The runners, he took out and deployed them with messages to the platoons, and to get to know where the platoons were so they could come back with messages. So I had the signalers, the company clerk, and another runner with us. And as I was going over the top, I saw a Japanese, and I up with my Tommy gun, and that bloody thing wouldn't fire. I won't go into details of that, because I've explained it before. I was disgusted to think that here, a professional soldier, a Japanese then, I couldn't hit him. And that same Japanese had been throwing grenades at our own men, and he scarpered, he ran away, because he heard us. He must have had no grenades left, or else we would have got them. I got the men down in this dry river bed, and there was a bit of a battle fight going on, but I never heard Bren guns firing. I never heard our rifles firing, but one or two desultory rounds. Now, I'd been in attacks before with the infantry in France. I'd been in practice attacks with live weapons. And you always get the Bren guns going, you get the rifles firing. There was none of that. Absolutely silence. All we're getting was Japanese firing. Nothing about us at all. It was unbelievable. Of course, the command officer further back, Colonel Thorbolls, wanting to know information, is on the set to me. What's happening, Sergeant Major? What's happening? He says, get the company commander. I said, the company commander's out with the platoons. He says, tell me what's happening. I said, sir, this is the funniest attack I've ever been in. I can't get a Bren gun. I can't get a rifle. Something's happened, but there's a stalemate. I've been up on the top. I've seen the area. There's nothing moving at all. All I can see is bodies. And he wanted to know more. I said, I can't tell you. I can only see people lying. I said, don't know whether they're live or dead. So he says, do something about them. What could I do? He says, get the men in. That meant get them into attack. Well, I only had the company headquarters with me. The other two platoons were off on their own, and then I went looking for the company commander, and I found him wounded. He'd been wounded in France in his knee. He could walk, but his same leg had been hit again, and he's badly bleeding. So I dragged him out, and I dragged him in through the nullahs, and I handed him over to Major Hungert of A Company. I mentioned Major Hungert previously when I lost my job. I handed him over to him. He gives a rum ration. Now, whilst he was questioning us on what was happening,